Warm salutations to one and all, and thank you for tuning in to episode 21 of the Roguecast. I trust you're all well and ready to surf the breeze in 2023. This episode, perhaps fittingly, is entitled The Knight Who Shut Down My Negligence Claim. How Sir Ross Cranston, former MP and Solicitor General to Tony Blair's government, was drafted in to halt a High Court suit against a negligent conveyancing solicitor. It's fair to say that I've had considerable first-hand experience of the judicial system and consequently witnessed the machinations of a variety of men and women who act as judges. I say this episode is fittingly entitled thus because two of my recent podcasts were also about knights or warriors, albeit fictional ones. However, the knight I am about to reveal is of an entirely different hue to either the Green Knight or Sir Gawain of the Round Table, an old British narrative which I cover in a previous episode. This knight, in my estimation, fell way short of the chivalric code of the knights of old. Now, before I begin to unravel the machinations, the strands of this knightly tale, I would encourage any listener who's not yet watched the documentary The Great British Mortgage Swindle or dug into the extensive collections of articles here in the Rogue Mortgage section of the site to do so. Back to the story. From the autumn of 2014 to the end of February 2015, I was the claimant in what became a High Court lawsuit against a former friend, who for the purposes of this recording we will refer to as Edward, who had acted negligently when he assured me that the mortgage I was entering into was lawful. Having revisited my article on the subject, it occurred to me that it's a story worthy of further explanation, not only for its clearly demonstrated elements of negligence, but also for the fact that in order to shut the case down, the judiciary brought in a knight of the realm. Whether or not said judiciary were leaned on by Lloyds the insurers for and on behalf of all those who engage in and wish to preserve the money extorting racket that is the Great British Mortgage Swindle, I cannot say. The man I am referencing is Sir Ross Cranston, but more on him later. First of all, let's go into the circumstances that led me to suing the conveyancing solicitor. In short, the tort of negligence claim against the conveyancing solicitor arose as a consequence of him falsely advising me that the mortgage I was entering way back in August 1994 was legal. However, due to the following elements, it most certainly was not. The listener can read more details of the mechanics of the mortgage swindle in the Rogue Mortgage section of the Rogue Mail site. However, in essence, it amounts to this. Number one, there was no written agreement, by which I mean contract, signed by all parties in accord with Section 2 of the Law of Property Act 1989. Two, the deed, which Edward asked me to sign but not date, was fraudulent on its face, being a financial instrument that I did not have the right to sign at the time, as I was not the owner of the property in question. It also acted as a false receipt for monies which I did not receive, being in fact a fraud that depends entirely on the faint notion that it was the Bradford and Bingley who was actually the lender. The Bradford and Bingley were the bank with whom I had the mortgage. In any agreement for a mortgage, both parties agree that it is the one who provides the funding who is owed the money. That individual who provides the money or provides the funding is, in fact, as a matter of accountancy fact, that individual is the duped mortgagor who is actually the creditor, as demonstrated by his promise to pay over the 25 years of the void mortgage. When I signed the mortgage offer and the false deed, this constituted, in effect, a promissory note. This was deposited in a bank account from whence the funding for the loan originated. The bank, in effect, stole that credit created by the deposit of the promissory note and misrepresented it back to me as a loan to which compound interest was added. 3. Thus, the conveyancing solicitor was negligent insofar as he failed to explain to me the mechanics of the swindle. You might well say, well, how could he, when he didn't understand? The answer to that is plain. I was paying him for his knowledge and expertise. As a professional conveyancer, he was duty-bound to provide valid legal knowledge. 4. When I was brutally evicted and the house stolen, it was as a direct consequence of me entering into a criminal agreement for a mortgage and signing the false documents, as he had advised me to do. Advice for which I paid him. I mean, what he didn't tell me at the time, which only became apparent when I started to try and resolve this matter privately between him and myself, was that he was representing the interests of the bank, the Bradford and Bingley at the time. He was being paid by them while simultaneously being paid by me. Why was he being paid by them? Because in essence, just like any other conveyancing solicitor who carries out this role between the mortgagor and the bank, he is being paid to procure that valuable instrument, namely the deed of mortgage. Now, that deed of mortgage is, as I've stated, on its face, a fraud, which, if we extrapolate from that, brings to question the entirety of the so-called securities markets. Because all they're doing, as far as I can see, is trading around fictional pieces of worthless paper. Let's dig into the rest of the story. Now, following the failure of the defendant, Edward, a conveyancing solicitor who was being paid for his legal advice, to settle, right, by way of private correspondence between myself and him, and through his professional indemnification insurance policy, a tort of negligence claim was filed. He failed to do that, so I was forced to go to court and file a tort of negligence claim at Nottingham County Court. That was on the 25th of October 2014, and it was against Edward and three other defendants who work alongside him at Fraser Brown Solicitors in Nottingham, who have subsequently been sold on to some organisation. So effectively they no longer exist as in the form that they did when this claim was started. I also should mention at this point that when you ask a professional legal individual for his indemnification details, in other words, his insurance details, because you may well have a negligence claim against him, he is duty-bound to provide them, and he's also duty-bound to inform his insurers of the fact. Now, what invariably happens is that the entirety of the claim against the individual is taken over by the insurers. So, in this matter, Edward stepped to one side, and I had to deal directly through the insurance company. And I think, if I recall correctly, it was one of those underlings at the insurers who was added to the claim as well, due to his failure to settle what was a demonstrably correct. The defendants failed to file a defence within the 28 days and instead made an unmeritorious application on the 28th of November for the negligence claim to be dismissed. A hearing was subsequently scheduled for the 23rd of January 2015. When HHJ Nigel Godsmark, the senior judge at Nottingham County Court, realised that he knew the first three defendants, all solicitors, all operating out of one firm, Fraser Brown, in the city of Nottingham, he recused himself from the proceedings. At the directions hearing on that day, the matter was transferred to the Queen's Bench Division of the High Court, with the agreement of both parties. Joseph Sullivan, the barrister representing the defendant, announced he would be seeking the issuance of an extended civil restraining order, an ECRO, banning myself, the claimant, from access to the courts on the fallacious ground that the claimant had run out of time under the Statute of Limitations Act and was a vexatious litigant, a tactic that had been used against the claimant before. In 2010, when I was fighting a fraudulent possession claim made by the Bradford and Bingley PLC that they had initiated way back in July 2009. That barrister, Joe Sullivan, was also seeking an order that the expert witness testimony of the forensic economist Timothy Madden, made in the shape of a detailed dissection of the void components of the mortgage agreement, be struck out, even though he had been appointed as such back in October 2013, as established by the private correspondence between myself and Edward. The hearing of the two applications was scheduled for Friday the 27th of February, to be heard before Judge Nicol. Remember that name. I was told that Judge Nicol would be the one presiding over the matter. The hearing in the Queen's Bench was of two applications then. The first application was an application by the defendant's barrister to have my claim struck out as being without merit on the false grounds it was out of time under the statute of limitations, along with the request for the inclusion of the expert witness report of Timothy Madden to be struck out. The second application was my application to have the defendant's application dismissed as, you guessed it, being without merit. As previously stated, this first-hand account is one that is concerned with the facts only, the intention being to focus not on the failings of the judiciary and the sophistry of the highly paid barrister, but on the bigger picture. After all, what is firmly established is simply that which remains standing after the voluminous waves of bullshit have subsided. With that in mind, let's make a factual note. The cause of action for a negligence claim does not begin until all the damages have been inflicted. In this case, all of the elements of a breach of duty by the conveyancing solicitor were in place, and they are duty, breach and damage, when the house was stolen on the 4th of November 2010, and not, as falsely claimed by Joe Sullivan in 2009, when I defended a fraudulent possession claim by the Bradford and Bingley and its agents. In other words, he was saying that I should have made the claim of negligence back in the initial hearing of August the 26th, 2009. But as we can see here, that's a nonsense. It's utterly fallacious because the damages claim did not actually begin until the house was stolen. In other words, the clock only started ticking at that point. The barrister falsely claimed that the statute of limitations had to be applied from the date the void mortgage was created, August the 8th, 1994. I hope the listener by now is beginning to see the levels of deception that are going on here. This was the sophistry of hand that was played by the barrister that resulted in what I can only describe as an unsafe judgment, a void judgment being delivered. Sophistry is defined as the use of fallacious arguments, especially with the intention of deceiving. The discerning listener will know that when one's opponent is attempting to use sophisticated arguments, or lies as some may prefer to call them, the individual's only defence is his capacity for reason. In other words, critical thinking, which can be used to break down any and all fallacies that are being used against him. The more I think about this, the more I see for myself that the most expensive barristers are quite simply those who are the best deceivers. Remember too, whilst prostitution is legal, soliciting remains illegal. Members of the legal professions are encouraged to make of that what they will. Another fact that requires some critical thinking is this. It was only 3 days after the hearing of the 27th of February 2015 that it came to my attention that it was not in fact the aforementioned Judge Nicol who had presided, but another judge of the Queen's Bench, namely Sir Ross Frederick Cranston, born the 23rd of July 1948 in Brisbane, Australia, styled the Honorary Mr. Justice Cranston, who is a High Court judge, formerly an academic lawyer and Labour Party politician in the United Kingdom. That's from Wikipedia. So you can see here another deception that, which was at play. Namely, that I didn't even know the identity of the man who was before me and presiding as the judge. For at no point prior to that did the court, the barrister for the defendants, or indeed the man himself, identify himself as Mr. Justice Cranston. The discerning listener is asked to make of that what he will. It's also worth noting that Ross Cranston has considerable academic experience and expertise in financial matters. Quote, he is also a visiting professor of law at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He was a member of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom from 1997 to 2005. He was Solicitor General from 1998 to 2001. Previously, he was Centennial Professor and Castle Professor of Commercial Law at the London School of Economics. Before that, he was Lubbock Professor of Banking Law and Director for the Centre for Commercial Law Studies at Queen Mary and Westfield College. He was educated in Australia and at Harvard Law School and Oxford. He held consultancies with UNCTAD, the World Bank, the IMF and the Commonwealth Secretariat to advise different countries on commercial banking and security laws. Yes, I bet he did. He has also undertaken peer reviews of the legal system for the European Commission in Bulgaria, Croatia and Turkey. He was a long-time member of the legal advisory panel of the National Consumer Council in Britain until 1997 and chair of trustees of the whistleblowers charity Public Concern at Work. He is a fellow of the British Academy. His book, Principles of Banking Law, is described thus. Written by a leading figure in this field, this book provides the most authoritative treatment of international banking and services law with in-depth expert coverage of global banking regulation, global payment systems, international bond instruments and foreign exchange systems. Unlike other texts, Cranston takes an international perspective on the subject, thus helping locate domestic banking / financial law in its wider context. End quote. Sir Ross Cranston, therefore, was Solicitor General to Tony Blair and, as Deputy to the Attorney General, was the one who provided legal advice to the Cabinet between 1998 and 2001, when he was succeeded by a certain Harriet Harman. 1998 to 2001. Now, what issues might he have been advising on in those years? I'll leave that for the listener to ponder. Little wonder, one might say, that he chose to ignore the salient fact that the deed of mortgage, in and of itself a valuable, negotiable financial instrument, procured by way of the demonstrably negligent advice of the defendant, was an on-its-face false document that fell foul of the law of mortgages. Just like those before him, the judge went nowhere near the meat of my argument, choosing instead to rely upon the misrepresentations of the defendant's barrister, who, by employing what was essentially a sophist approach, sold him the lie that the claimant was time-barred from bringing the negligence. By buying that lie, the professor erred in law. Given the foregoing, it's hardly surprising then that the softly spoken Joe Sullivan seemed content to rely entirely upon the claim being falsely dismissed as being out of time, and went nowhere near a rebuttal of my argument about the fatal defects of the deed of mortgage itself and the conveyancing solicitor's blatant negligence by way of his omissions to point out those material defects as well as the self-evidentiary statutory failures of the bank under the Law of Property Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1989, Sections 1 and 2. The salient point is this. Who in his right mind would enter a mortgage agreement that is fraudulent on its face, other than an individual who has been negligently advised by a solicitor who, unbeknownst to him, is simultaneously being paid by the alleged lender for his procurement of the valuable security, the deed of mortgage, which is essentially a cash asset to the bank. In other words, the individual goes in seeking a mortgage and establishes himself to be the creditor by his acceptance of the by his signing of the mortgage offer and the deed of mortgage over a property which at that particular moment he did not actually own, making it an illegal disposition. After all, how can anyone agree to a charge over a property that is not theirs? More fallacial thinking. This, unless we forget, is the very nub of the matter. For without that false advice that the mortgage was illegal, would the mortgagor have suffered any losses by way of payments made under an invalid mortgage agreement? And was it not the fact of the void agreement for a mortgage as entered upon the defendant's false assurance that it was valid that led to the fraudulent possession claim being made against him back in 2009? That led, in turn, to the violent theft of his house. Why didn't the solicitor reveal at the time of his working for me that he was also being paid by the alleged lender? Could it be he wished to hide the facts of this blatant conflict of interest from me? Sometimes, when I look back over all this, I am astonished at how I was duped. But having said that, it's simply a case of knowledge being power, and I did not really have any understanding of the mortgage racket. I, like millions of others, falsely believed that I'd been in receipt of a loan of monies from the bank. In other words, depositors' monies that were loaned to me. And naturally, I was under an obligation to pay them back, or so I thought. But the mechanics of the mortgage swindle are manifestly clear. Namely, that the mortgagor, the individual who goes in seeking a mortgage, is in fact the creditor to the bank. It is, after all, his promissory note that is deposited. That promissory note is a valuable security. Professor Richard Werner claims that the banks are not in the business of making loans, that they are in the business of buying and selling securities. But what Professor Werner seems to be missing is this point that the banks are in their entirety a criminal racketeering system, and that the banks, when it comes to a mortgage at least, are certainly not in the business of buying and selling mortgages. They're in the business of fraudulently procuring those mortgages and then selling them on by the process of securitisation. Which brings up the question as to who is the holder in due course of the mortgage note, the mortgage. A question which I asked in episode 17 of The Roadcast. In any event, let's focus on what was established at the hearing of the 27th of February 2015. 1. There was no rebuttal of the facts of the void mortgage. The falsity of the documentation, the failure of the defendant to point out the legal omissions of both the deed and the mortgage contract under Section 2 of the Law of Property Act 1989. 2. The judge erred in law by falsely ruling that the claimant was statute barred from bringing the negligence claim, as it had to fall within 15 years of the Negligent Act. 3. A negligence claim is valid when all its elements are there. Duty of care, breach of duty of care, and loss, which for the survivor of the Great British Mortgage Swindle is the day the house is stolen. 4. A mortgagor can rely upon the defects of the deed of mortgage as per Bank of Scotland versus WOF, a High Court ruling from 2014. 5. A negligent solicitor cannot rely upon the fallacy of common practice when that common practice is on an industrial scale. 6. By ignoring the meat of the claimant's argument, the judge failed to provide a competent jurisdiction, choosing instead to rely upon the false argument of the defendant's barrister that the claim was statute barred under the Statute of Limitations Act 1980. 7. By not disclosing to the claimant who he was, Judge Cranston, Sir Ross Cranston, put me at a distinct disadvantage to the barrister who evidently knew in advance who the judge was. You see, had I known exactly who this man in front of me, this knight of the realm, was and his background, I could quite reasonably have asked for him to recuse himself on the simple basis that, as the next question will identify, on the following grounds. 1. Given his ministerial role in the criminal government of Tony Blair, in which he was Solicitor General, giving advice to that criminal government, could Ross Cranston be deemed impartial enough to preside over a matter as significant as the Great British Mortgage Swindle? 2. Why did he ignore the factual defects of the mortgage and those authorities by which the court is bound? After all, is he not a self-professed expert in these matters? 3. Why did he not provide any substantive reasoning as to how and why the negligence claim was without merit? 4. Why was he chosen to preside over this matter? Why was he drafted in? Why did they bring in a Knight of the Realm? A man of clearly some authority and high social status within the corridors of fake power. And why was I not informed of his appointment in advance? After all, it was clear to me that the defendant solicitor, Joseph Sullivan, knew who this man was. 5. Why was the judiciary seeking to ban me from the courts for a second time? 6. Has the Rothschildian court service once again failed under international law to provide a competent jurisdiction? I suppose that's what you might call a rhetorical question. 7. How can a claim that potentially affects 40 million people across the Isles of Britain be possibly dismissed as being without merit? Now, it's to be noted that this article was written nearly 8 years ago now, but sometimes one gets the impression that, you know, you can be a bit some distance ahead of the wave that's coming. And I do wonder if that might be the case here, because the conclusion that I came to 8 years ago is pretty much, I don't think I'd change it. In fact, I would suggest that it's probably more pertinent now, or more clear, should I say, to people now than it was then. This is the conclusion: that the entire conveyancing industry is teetering on the brink of collapse. Like a pair of Dutch schoolboys, the judge and barrister were attempting the impossible. After all, there are not enough fingers on earth to plug the glaring holes in this huge damn wall that is spouting leaks at all points, and sooner rather than later, the whole edifice will burst. Everywhere we turn these days, we can see fraud in operation. From the traitorous appointment of Rishi Sunak, I don't really need to go into any detail at this point, but what I'm saying is that there are so many holes in all these public narratives that they cannot be plugged, that those holes are just growing more and more. There are not enough thumbs to stick in them. So eventually, what will happen? The holes will grow bigger, and eventually the waters will rush over the dam and the whole thing will collapse, because, as I've stated many times, it's built on the quicksands of fraud. All of it is built on lies. As I said previously, even the negotiable security, the instrument called the deed of mortgage, is on its face a fraudulent document. So as I said, what is it they believe that they're trading? What is it that have these Standard and Poor ratings? What are these securities? It is, in many ways, a clown world in which everything is an illusion, and that those illusions are simply hidden behind a variety of smoke and mirrors. And in this matter, you can see, hopefully, from the way I've outlined what happened, that I was subject to just that, a gameplay that involves smoke and mirrors, obfuscation, the use of fallacious argument, the threat against me of another extended civil restraint in order to keep me out of the courts. And also, let's just make this point, at the end of that hearing, costs were awarded against me of some £17,000. Now, why hasn't Edward and Fraser Brown, the solicitors firm, come after me for those costs? I mean, they're out of time now, because ironically enough, the statute of limitations does kick in. So I know for a fact that what I stated was clear and established the facts of the matter. It seems to me that the insurers employed who were the ones who paid for the barrister, wanted to cover this up at all costs. And somehow, through whatever influence they had, Ross Cranston, the Knight of the Realm, was drafted in to assist in the railroading of this valid claim of negligence. That would suggest to me that they took it very seriously and that it was a huge matter that they would attempt to cover up at all costs, or, as is often the case, simply kick the can down the road. Remember, at no point was my argument dismissed as being without merit. In any event, and as I stated on the public record at the time, there is no statutory limit on an act of professional negligence that leads to fraud and criminality being perpetrated against someone. How could there be? There was no premise for striking out the negligence claim as being without merit, so the barrister and judge had to cook one up. This imminent collapse I've referenced is simply too enormous for the legal profession to acknowledge, which is why, as demonstrated by the void nature of Ross Cranston's judgment, they and their cohorts are in deep denial. Cognitive dissonance rules okay. Sadly, and contrary to the disingenuous mutterings of the expensive barrister, judgments like this bring the judiciary into disrepute. As stated by the claimant when the false accusation was levelled at me that I was that I had brought the judiciary into disrepute, I said the case is clear that it is each and every judge across the Isles of Britain who has failed to apply the law of mortgages since the 26th of September 1989 who has brought the judiciary into disrepute. I stated on the record at the time, much to the annoyance of Ross Cranston, that to suggest I brought the British judiciary into disrepute is like blaming a mafia victim for his own murder. An analogy for sure, but one which nevertheless is applicable to a matter in which a man was subjected to a genocidal and wholly unlawful eviction. As the record will demonstrate, the judge was overly preoccupied with establishing that the claim was time-barred so he could strike out a valid negligence claim that is of interest to over 11 million mortgagors in the British Isles alone. Hence his constant interruption with questions regarding the chronology of proceedings. In so doing, Ross Cranston ignored the proven elements of the defendant's negligence and wrongly asserted the negligence claim was time-barred insofar as the claimant should have raised the issues in previous hearings in 2009, which was some years prior to my discovery of further information and the moment when, as a matter of fact, the elements of the willful negligence were in place, the 4th of November 2010, when the house was stolen. At that point, I had a cause of action for a negligence claim. In short, although it was another void judgment which further perverts the course of justice and serves as ever only the vested interests of the criminal Rothschildian financial establishment and those members of the legal profession who sup from its poisonous chalice, the validity of the claim against the conveyancing solicitor for his manifest professional negligence in falsely advising that the mortgage was lawful was a sound one. None of its factual elements were rebutted. The levels of judicial misconduct by those judges who failed to apply the law in any and all fraudulent mortgage claims made by phony lenders and their whoring solicitors is the huge scandal that implicates them in the treachery that is the Great British Mortgage Swindle. I've attached a downloadable link to the sanitised version of the tort of negligence claim against Edward, the conveyancing solicitor. Anyone who's in a similar position should perhaps may want to get in touch and ask me a few questions about it, and they're welcome to do so. Thank you for listening, and I'd just like to say anyone who can spare a few quid is invited to make a donation via the donate button on the site, which is when you use the PayPal link, please send it as the family or friend option. In the next episode, I will be revealing for the first time how I sued two constables of Nottingham Police Force and won the case for damages. In the meantime, my very best wishes to all listeners as we each continue our individual journeys through this simulacrum we call life. Cheers.